The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. Good Friday to you, last day of the week, our final broadcast, our final live broadcast. All these programs, as you well know, posted at thetrumpet.com every single day. Also, the kpcg.fm website. Well, lots of excitement here at Edstone this morning as my father's traveling party arrived at the Birmingham International Airport. Just about 20 miles from the Edstone campus. They touched down a little bit after 9 o'clock this morning, and they're all safe and sound, embedded into the bowels of Edstone. He's got his daughter, my sister, traveled along with him, and also a few others. Andrew Loker's here. He'll be subbing in for me here at Edstone next week on this program, so you'll be hearing from him from this side of the pond. And lots of things going on this weekend, next week, the following weekend, the annual college campout. So these next 7-8 days are just going to be absolutely crazy with activity. Very exciting, very fun, but crazy with activity for sure. And of course, this Sunday, we've got the first ever online appearance campaign. It's going to be broadcast live from our new Edstone TV studio. We go live here at the Edstone studio at 4 p.m. Sunday afternoon. That's 10 a.m. Central Time in the United States. And we'd love for you to join us for that presentation. All you need to do to view the live video is to make sure that you have an account at our website, thetrumpet.com. And if you're logged in on Sunday, and make sure that you do it 15, 20 minutes before the live presentation so that you're good to go, you're ready to go, then you should be able to see the live stream right at thetrumpet.com website. We've had some issues in recent weeks with our website. Earlier this week, I guess it was Monday, so that went on for a number of hours, and I thought I'd just pass along to you some statistics. Edwin Trable sent me these yesterday. Some really positive signs, some positive statistics regarding the website and the traffic just this year as it compares to 2018. So even with some of the troubles that we've had, we're seeing some nice increases right across the board. He reports that 5% of the Trumpet PDF downloads, or rather it's up 5% over 2018. Also, we're 11% ahead this year as compared to last year with respect to unique page views. And we've also seen a 29% bump in orders for literature, physical literature, people on the website sending in for a hard copy of such and such booklet. We've seen a 24% jump in online literature reads, people reading a booklet or a book online. And then finally, it says here 34% above last year as far as PDF downloads are concerned. So that's some encouraging stats, even though we have been struggling with some technical issues here and there. We're still seeing a bump in the overall traffic, the request for literature, and so on. And speaking of the website, by the way, we've got a relaunch coming up, I think, on Monday. So we've got the online pack event on Sunday, and then we've redesigned a few pages on the trumpet.com website. And so hopefully, if all goes well today and through the weekend, you'll be seeing that on Monday morning or certainly sometime next week. So we're very excited about that as well. Well, lots of things that we could talk about today. Dominating the U.S. news cycle once again, even though it's, I guess, significant. I touched on it yesterday. The hoax, the hate crime hoax It is a significant story, but it's just yet another story that now we're going to be hearing about this for days on end. And then it'll give way to another story that really, in the grand scheme of things, is not really consequential at all. I wanted to start today with President Obama's, or the former president, Barack Obama, his presidential library, that, or if you want to call it that, I guess. You'll see what I mean here in just a moment. But you don't hear much about this, the controversy swirling around this this complex, but it has been hotly disputed. This it's a $375 million presidential center, I guess it's called, and it's meeting quite a lot of resistance right in Barack Obama's hometown of Chicago. It says here, this is from the Weekly Standard, this is about 6-8 months old, but it says, rather it's blowing, talking about the resistance, how that, well, the article sets it up by saying it usually comes from conservatives or the Republican Party, but this time the resistance is blowing from the very people who have long lionized Obama: white Chicago lakefront progressives, University of Chicago professors, environmentalists, African-American activists, and a community organization of the kind that once employed Obama as an organizer. They're all fighting this. What Barack Obama wants to do with this presidential center in this very ritzy part of Chicago. Another article, it says here, this is from February, just a few days ago. It says, the court battle over the Obama Presidential Center is a variation on a theme playing out around the country and beyond. Economic development decisions, inclusive planning, and transparency are bullet points in land use battles. So that's what the battle is over, how this land is going to be used. It's at a famous park. I forget the name of it. But anyway, it talks about some struggles that Amazon and Google have had, Apple, some of these mega companies in the United States. And it says here, beloved by liberals for his message of hope and change, Obama might seem an unlikely figure to join a lineup with often criticized corporate behemoths like Google, Apple, and Amazon. But the charges Southsiders are aiming at the Obama Center, that the project involves secretive tactics, public giveaways, and a refusal to negotiate with representatives of local communities, may sound familiar to activists who have battled those companies' development schemes. So they've been fighting against these big internet, these corporate behemoths, as it says there, Google, Apple, Amazon, and now Barack Obama and this presidential center, this $375 million project. The New York Times talked about another angle of this story. There's the property dispute and whether or not there's all these giveaways and underhanded deals and so on. But then you have the fact that this is far from what we've seen from previous presidents going back, several decades. The center that he's proposing to build, really the proposal was a couple of years ago, and it's just now getting more and more attention, so much so that the New York Times is weighing in on the fact that, well, this really isn't even a presidential library. It says here, this is from Wednesday's New York Times. It says, the Obama Presidential Center promises to be a presidential library like no other. The four-building, 19-acre working center for citizenship, set to be built in a public park on the south side of Chicago, will include a 235-foot museum tower, a two-story event space, an athletic center, a recording studio, a winter garden, even a sledding hill. It's like an amusement park in many ways. It says, but the center will cost an estimated $500 million, so even more than that one I read previously from last June. $500 million will also differ from the complexes built by Barack Obama's predecessors in another way. It won't actually be a presidential library. It's not going to be a library. It says here, in a break with precedent, there will be no research library on site and none of Mr. Obama's official presidential records. Instead, the Obama Foundation will pay to digitize the roughly 30 million pages of unclassified paper records from the administration so they can be made available online. So that's how it's being sold. Well, we're going to make it all available. It's going to be online somewhere, but we're not going to have the actual research library on site. We're not going to have the actual hard copies of these presidential documents. The Times says here the entire complex, including the museum chronicling Mr. Obama's presidency, will be run by the foundation, a private nonprofit entity, rather than the National Archives and Records Administration, the federal agency that administers the libraries and museums for all presidents going back to Herbert Hoover. So this is going on almost a century now. And he's breaking with precedent, and he's starting an amusement park. For the first time, no research library on site, no presidential records. Talks about how that this plan was unveiled a couple of years ago, May of 2017, and that there was very little fanfare, not a lot that was going on at the time, or not much of a response to it, in fact. But it says here, but as awareness of the plan has spread, some historians, listen to this, some historians see a threat to future scholarship on the Obama administration and to the presidential library system itself. The Times says, without a dedicated repository, they argue, the rich constellations of related material found at the other libraries, papers donated by family members, cabinet members, and aides, as well as presidential and personal papers, could end up scattered or even uncollected. And without help from specialized archivists, it says, the promised digital democratization could just as easily turn into a hard-to-navigate data dump. So this looks very suspicious. This looks very, well, let's just say it's not very transparent. That's the way that it's shaping up to be. And some scholars and historians are now voicing their concerns. Wait a minute. Wait a minute. There are scores of books to be written about his presidency. And we need a center. We need a research library on site. We need all of those official presidential records in one location and the researchers to go with it. There's lots of history to be written here, and it's got to be based on facts, does it not? It says, more broadly, there's a concern that the creation of a privately run presidential museum undermines the ideal of nonpartisan public history. This is very different than what every president since Herbert Hoover has been doing. It says Timothy Naftali, the former director of the Richard Nixon Library, where he is credited with overhauling museum exhibits to give a more honest accounting of Watergate, called the decision a huge mistake. It's astounding to me. I can't even believe this next bit here. But it says here, it was astounding to me that a good presidency would do this, Mr. Naftali said. It opens the door, he added, to a truly terrible Trump library. So the problem is it's already the Trump library. That's the problem. Because of what Barack Obama is doing, this is the only time that they'll sound the alarm. Well, if this is done, think about what Donald Trump is going to do with this. And we're nowhere near the presidential library for Donald Trump. It says here, in addition to millions of pages of paper, the Obama presidential records include some 300 million emails, as well as Snapchat posts, tweets, and other born digital records. It talks about how that the military, they came in convoys back in 2016, started shipping these documents, millions of them, 30 million pages of documents, artifacts, and so on, to this site, this warehouse in Illinois, just waiting for their place in the presidential library. Now we come to find out that, well, there is no place for these documents. Where do they go? Well, we're not sure yet, but they'll be available somehow. Don't you worry, says the Obama team. Don't you worry. Hey, we're transparent. We've always been that way. That's what they say. And meanwhile, they get away with things like this. And really, it's so egregious that one of Obama's greatest fans, the New York Times, is now reporting on this. Even reporting someone that loves Barack Obama, saying this is dangerous because if he does this, well, just think about what Donald Trump might do. It says in May 2017, when President Obama appeared in Chicago to unveil the design for the center, renderings included a 50,000 square foot library building. He has that in quotes. But the research facility and archives most people had assumed would be inside, it had disappeared. So the research, the documents, they're not going to be in the actual library building. We don't know yet, I guess, where they'll be. The decision has not been made, or it's not yet been disclosed how these documents are going to be made available. The New York Times says some observers are dismayed at what they see as the lack of transparency and the slow trickle of information from both the foundation and the National Archives. They just can't get the story straight. They can't get it. Well, what's going to happen here? And so it's been 2 years, like the article says. Early on, there was very little in the way of feedback or criticism even. But now people are beginning to wake up to what's really happening. It says, as for research support, a spokeswoman for the National Archives said it would have the same dedicated kinds of staff for the Obama materials as it has at existing presidential libraries, but would not say where they would be located or provide any further details. Isn't that strange? It says, finally, some scholars are alarmed by the decision. The absence of a true Obama presidential library will have the effect of discouraging serious and potentially critical research into the Obama presidency. That's according to a Pulitzer Prize-winning historian. It's going to discourage serious and potentially critical research into the Obama presidency. Really, when I read this yesterday afternoon, I just thought, well, it sounds very similar to the way Hillary Clinton operated as Secretary of State and what she was doing when she was under investigation and had all of those files subpoenaed and then went to work scrubbing the servers and then went to work bleach bidding her computers, her phones, just doing away with the record, doing away with the paper trail. This is, some have said, a new approach to a presidential library. That's how it's been described in publications that think this is innovative. They think this is, well, this is the new age, the information age. This is how it should be. Over at Wired, this is from 2 years ago, it says, you won't find much in the way of paper files at this Obama library. Only electronic ones. The physical documents will remain in the National Archives at a location to be determined. This was from 2 years ago. This says Belmonte says that highlights an irony of the Obama administration. Even as the 44th president claimed to favor transparency, he didn't always practice it. So here he is, as far from transparent as you can be, and still, like you heard from the New York Times, they cannot resist sounding the alarm about Donald Trump and what Donald Trump might do when what we're seeing right now is actually happening. Another one from last year, both Barack Obama and Michelle Obama have made it clear that the center will be unlike any previous presidential library, a living place, not a research center or memorial where the emphasis will be on programming, it says. Programming, not hagiography, not research, not study, not book writing, nothing like that. All the presidential papers, they're going to be at a different location. And so the fight continues over the property. And now the criticism comes in full, over the documents themselves. And you're not going to get too much coverage on this. At least there's that bit from the New York Times. What an interesting story. And what does it say, even about, leaving aside the politics of it all, what does it say about this so-called innovative way of thinking when it comes to presidential centers, when the documents, the original sources, are not so important? If we lose some of them along the way, or if we just make it a big data dump where you can't really navigate your way through it, it's not a big deal. We don't need the record to be there from start to finish. We know what happened. We know who's righteous. We know who's good. We know who's evil. Never mind the facts. This is the direction we're going. In the university, as a society, among politicians as well. The last couple of years, you've had one example after another of these young 20-somethings, young people. I mentioned on yesterday's show, the ones that got up out of class and to protest in favor of doing something for climate change. They just left their classrooms on Friday last week and then assembled around Trafalgar Square, this landmark celebrating glorious history for the British Empire. I went through some of that yesterday. Go back and listen to that program again at thetrumpet.com if you like. But then this caught my eye this morning, this Washington Post piece, I guess it's from a day or two ago, about these young people in a place called Dunn, North Carolina, where they they tried to destroy the monument to General William C. Lee. Who is he? Well, I didn't know who he was either, but here he is, this military figure from American history. And well, I'll let the local news, this is from North Carolina, and they're describing the controversy over this historical monument. This is clip one.
The passion over Confederate monuments has found yet another victim. Protesters knocked down a Confederate soldier statue in Durham back in 2017.
And then last year, another group at UNC tore down Silent Sam. But the latest statue hit with vandalism isn't a Confederate statue at all. It's a monument to General William C. Lee in Dunn. CBS 17's Kelly Kennedy spoke with the museum's curator, who thinks the vandals messed with the wrong statue.
The controversy surrounding Confederate monuments has resulted in the vandalism of statues across the South.
I never even thought it would affect us in any way at all.
Mark Johnson is curator of the William C. Lee Airborne Museum in Dunn. He thought for sure this statue of General William C. Lee would be safe from the chaos.
This is a hometown grown boy here that turned out to be an international hero in World War II. So to come and try to destroy his statue is just an insult to everybody.
Police tell me someone doused this statue in some kind of a flammable liquid and set it on fire. You can see the scorch marks here on the side of the statue.
I think it was a big mistake. Why would you do something like this? Really just to irritate people at you.
Johnson thinks the vandals wanted to make a statement about slavery and racism. He thinks the vandals could use a history lesson.
This is not a Civil War museum, and this is not Robert E. Lee, this is General William C. Lee, so I was hurt.
Besides sharing the same last name, General Robert E. Lee and General William C. Lee have nothing in common and are not related.
What does that say about our educational system today? They have nothing in common with each other. Here's this World War II hero and young people who, well, they see the same last name. It must be Robert E. Lee. Doesn't matter that he's dressed up in World War II outfit. It says Lee on the end, so we need to destroy it. We need to burn it down. This has been going on now for years, several years. It's picked up in particularly during the Trump presidency. But here is this international hero. He's considered to be, what did the Washington Post say? The one that's described as the father of the U.S. Army's airborne infantry. And here are these young people trying to destroy it. In Primus, the publication sent out by Hillsdale College, they posted an article. I guess it was about a week ago. It's from a speech from back in July of 2018, so 6 or 8 months ago. And I failed to write down the individual's name who gave this speech, but he asked in this speech if we should defend. Shall we defend our common history? Shouldn't we defend the history? Shouldn't we try to uphold this history or preserve it? He says over the past several years, we've seen a rising tide of assaults on statues and other works of art representing our nation's history by those who are eager to squeeze that complex story into a box defined by the evolving rules of political correctness. They squeeze the history into their box. And the standards are the rules. It's determined by political correctness. And if there's some history that we don't like, this is George Orwell, it's right out of 1984. If there's some history we don't like, then we just erase it. We delete it. We get rid of it. Who needs the paper trail? History, in other words, is dead. This author says we might call this the monument controversy. A vocal minority claiming victim status demands the destruction, removal, or concealment of some object of which they disapprove. Usually, the official response is instant capitulation. That's typically the way that we respond. We just immediately surrender. If the young people say to do it, then we do it. If they start burning down pictures or statues or important historical landmarks, if they pull down statues, then they must be right. And we've got to obey. It says in the background is the conviction that we blessed members of the most enlightened cohort ever to grace the earth with its presence, occupy a moral plane superior to all who came before us. Consequently, the defacement of murals of Christopher Columbus and statues of later historical figures like Teddy Roosevelt is perfectly virtuous and above criticism, since human beings in the past were by definition so much less enlightened than we are. That's really the important point to take away from this Imprimis article. It's the arrogance of our university system to teach our young people that we are so morally superior to our ancestors. We know so much more. He gives quite a few examples in his presentation. Even William Shakespeare. This was at the University of Pennsylvania. There was a portrait of William Shakespeare in the English department, a hallway in the English department. They had to get rid of it because, well, we need more diversity. He's white. We need to be diverse. And Primus says here, in the bad old days, and listen to this, and again, think about it with respect to what's going on with the presidential center in Chicago, or the one that the Obama team wants to build. It says, in the bad old days, librarians and college presidents were people who sought to protect the past, that vast storehouse of offensive attitudes and behavior that also just so happens to define our common inheritance. It says, in our more enlightened times, many librarians and college presidents collude in its effacement. They're the ones working to erase the history. The researchers, the librarians, the college presidents, the faculty. And then listen to this conclusion. It says, to listen to many race peddlers these days, you would think they regarded George Orwell's warning in 1984 as a how-to manual. He quotes from Orwell. It says, every record has been destroyed or falsified. Every book has been rewritten. Every picture has been repainted. Every statue and street and building has been renamed. Every date has been altered. And that process is continuing day by day and minute by minute. History, he says. This is Orwell from 1984. History has stopped. And this guy is speaking last year at Hillsdale, based upon the recent imprimis. He says at stake is nothing less than the survival of our common history. We don't even have a common history anymore. It's being erased. And so surprise, surprise, when you see people today talking about their truth. Well, it doesn't matter if you don't agree with me or if you think that I'm lying. This is my version. This is my history. This is my truth. You have your truth and I have mine. It'll be interesting to see how that this hate crime hoax plays out if the perpetrator really and truly does go to jail for a long time, or if in the end he just gets a slap on the wrist. He's already got people rushing to his defense. He's got his allies. He still has his allies in the mainstream media. They do have some egg on their face this week, that's true. But still, the way that this is playing out, it is. It's like something that comes right out of the book, 1984. History has stopped. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to email the program, you can send comments to td@kpcg.fm. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily. The developed nations have made awesome progress. They have produced a highly mechanized world, providing every luxury, modern convenience, and means of pleasure. Yet they are cursed with crime, violence, injustice, sickness and disease, broken homes and families. At the same time, more than one half the world is living in illiteracy, abject poverty, filth and squalor. Violence and destruction are rapidly multiplying. Many ask, why, if God exists, does he allow so much violence and human suffering? To understand the reason behind this astonishing paradox, request a complimentary copy of Mystery of the Ages. We were born into this 20th century world as it is. We take it for granted, but we can't explain it. It's like viewing a movie at a point already near the end. We see what is occurring at that point, but not having seen it from the beginning and not knowing how events developed to the point of viewing, we simply cannot understand what we are seeing. Mystery of the Ages transports you back to the beginning of the movie, to the foundation of this present evil world. To learn more, please visit thetrumpet.com. This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily.
That last segment, it just makes me think about the John Adams biography. I gave you some of these tidbits a few months ago, where Adams, writing back at the founding of the United States, was talking about how the government needed to encourage the development of an educated populace. People need to be educated. The young people need to be educated. McCullough said about Adams, it was in all a declaration of Adams's faith in education as the bulwark of a good society, the old abiding faith of his Puritan forebears. It says the survival of the rights and liberties of the people depended on the spread of wisdom, knowledge, and virtue among all people, the common people. The common people need this. The common people need to understand this. They need to know their history. They need to know their roots. And it used to be that you had the librarians, the research assistants, the college presidents, the college faculty. They used to be the fierce defenders of the historical record, the original sources, the original documents. But today, history has stopped. And even the teachers are leading the way, colluding with the young in their effacement of these historical landmarks. I'd like to go and, just like this Imprimis speaker did last year, and just look at these stories that come up, it seems now, every few weeks, case by case by case. And now it's so bad that even the statue of a World War II general, an international hero, had nothing to do with the Civil War, had nothing to do with slavery, had nothing to do with anything that far back. He wasn't alive. Now statues like that are coming down, or at least they're trying to bring them down. Well, I just wanted to finish the show with a few more news items. This one here that was handed to me yesterday from, I think it's from Time Magazine, about how Americans view foreign policy. It just shows how that historically Americans have supported a more isolationist foreign policy. It's a fascinating look into a nation that has lost the pride of its power. It's been broken, as Leviticus 26 says. But Time.com says, no matter what party they claim allegiance to, Americans favor a foreign policy that resists entanglements abroad. This is according to a recent survey. And it's not limited to conservative libertarians on the right and liberal pacifists on the left. This is just America in general. They don't want to get entangled into foreign wars. That's been our history. And the point that this article makes is that Donald Trump is out there saying, we're going to pull our troops out. And we've talked before about Syria and Afghanistan and so on. But he's out there saying, we're going to bring our boys home. And even though he gets criticized, there are quite a few people, as this article brings out, that agree with him. Time.com says, for all of the criticism of his chaotic and abrasive decision-making, Trump understands this wariness, the wariness of the American people, that is. Some insist he has hijacked the U.S. foreign policy by expressing public doubt about the value of existing alliances and an interventionist foreign policy, but in many ways, Trump's views align more closely than others in Washington, D.C., with the ways in which a majority of American taxpayers would define the future U.S. role in the world. It says, America first isn't just a Trump catchphrase. When it comes to foreign policy, it's becoming a national worldview. This is what America wants. We want to focus on our home, not go out abroad and fix the problems of this world. We want to fix the problems here at home. And you see, as I said in the first segment, you see the same tendency in the mainstream media and just the stories that they report on, just what it is that they're interested in. It's not just that we want to pull back and turn inward. In far too many cases, there just isn't much concern at all for what's happening in the world at large. We've been talking in recent weeks about Europe's split with the United States and how significant this is with respect to Bible prophecy. It's an important trend that we're following. I talked just on Monday of this week, following the Munich Security Conference, and how that you saw that on full display last weekend. America split with the European Union. Here's a conference that used to highlight all the common interests between the United States and the European Union. But now what you see on display is the differences with trade, defense, NATO, whatever it might be. And of course, Donald Trump, he's always singled out. On Wednesday, President Trump. He met with the Austrian Chancellor, Sebastian Kurz, his first visit to the White House, and the EU Observer, as have many others, spoke about the rift in the relationship between the U.S. and Europe. And even though Kurz and Donald Trump do share some similar conservative principles, you did see more of that rift, particularly with respect to trade. This exchange that I have here from Wednesday's meeting, what's interesting, there's some nice pleasantries exchanged. This is President Trump introducing Sebastian Kurz, and then Mr. Kurz's reaction or response to him. And then I'll come back after that and tell you what the press, or how the press, reacted to this meeting. But first, here's clip two.
We're going to be discussing numerous things, immigration today, but we're also discussing trade. We have a very big trade presence and a very good relationship on trade. Do a lot of business with each other. And Chancellor, it's very nice to have you. Thank you very much. Thank you. Please.
Thank you, Mr. President, for receiving us here in the U.S. and the White House. It's a pleasure for my delegation and for me to be here. Austria, as you probably know, is compared to the U.S., a very small country, but we are a beautiful country.
It's true.
We are an economically quite strong country. You would probably say a great country. We are in the heart of the European Union, an active member state of the European Union. As a small country, we need international cooperation, and therefore I hope that we can discuss now our bilateral relations, but also the relations between the European Union and the United States of America. Of course, trade and how we can gain economic growth for the U.S., but also for Europe.
And so trade primarily. And then following that, if you watch the press conference, for the most part, the reporters, they could not care less about this meeting or about Austria or about the European Union. Immediately, they just launched into the Mueller this, or what about this, or did you see McCabe's interview on 60 Minutes, or and on it goes. And so we miss the significance of this ever-expanding chasm between the United States and Europe, this growing rift, and it revolves, so much of it revolves around trade. Like I say, you put this populist movement in Austria together with what happened in 2016 in the United States, and there's some common interest that you could point out with respect to Kurz and Mr. Trump. But as it is, you see, and particularly when you put it together with other reports coming along, the trade war, or the oncoming trade war, we've noted before on this program and at thetrumpet.com, how that Germany uses the weak euro to help itself on trade. All of its exports are super cheap, or at least cheaper than they would be otherwise, because of the weak economy in Greece and Spain and Italy. That brings the whole euro down. And so Germany's able to feast on this. That's why there's such a trade surplus. And they can make their cars artificially cheaper, which is a big hit with people shopping for cars abroad. So Mr. Trump has threatened to put tariffs on European cars, and Kurz and so many of the other European leaders, they're not happy about that at all. And you know about the history with the Nord Stream 2 pipeline, the strong rebuke that the president's had for Germany on that deal. Well, Austria supports the deal. The U.S. has also encouraged Austria to spend more money on the military, just like it's done with Germany. So this is, again, this is an important story to watch. My father in the Trumpet, thetrumpet.com, well, in the magazine too, he had the article recently about the Holy Roman Empire goes public big time. I guess that was a few months ago. But he pointed to the prophecies about all of these strongmen and their close ties to the Vatican, to the Church at Rome, And that's what we want to be looking for when we look at fulfilled prophecy. When we look at Revelation 17, the woman straddling the beast, the 10 kings, they come together with one mind. It's an iron and clay mixture, yes, but they come together for a short time with one mind, one purpose. And it's like Mr. Armstrong said in that clip I always play. You put 400 million people together, and then all of their militaries and such. Brad McDonald wrote in a trumpet brief just a few weeks ago. He talked about, well, you have the United States. You have Donald Trump going after European cars or automobiles, threatening to slap a tariff there. And then you look at the way the EU treats the American tech companies, Google and Facebook and Apple and so on. The EU's constantly looking to pass new laws to control the internet. And we're based in Europe, the regional office here in the UK. And you feel it. You see it. In that trumpet brief, Mr. McDonald says, this is raw imperialism, regulatory imperialism, what the EU does, these new laws to control the internet. It says the EU today is using the GDPR, that's the General Data Protection Regulation. They're using the GDPR and other regulatory tactics to colonize the internet. Europe wants to conquer the world all over again. He's quoting from Politico earlier in 2018. Further on in Mr. McDonald's piece, it says, using the GDPR, the EU has invaded every home, government, and corporation on Earth that uses the internet. Across the planet, governments and corporations have had to invest millions of dollars and countless man hours to figure out how to respond to and to comply with the GDPR. More than 500 million people live inside the EU. And they're relatively wealthy, he says. This is the prosperous West, Western nations. It says, and more than 85% of them have access to the internet. For many governments, businesses, and other organizations, ignoring the European market is not an option. On the other hand, foreign companies cannot simply ignore GDPR. Failing to comply with the regulations could garner a fine of up to 20 million euro. That's about $22 or $23 million. It says, in the end, if a government or corporation wants to do business with the European Union, it has only one option, surrender. That's the option. And the thing about the EU is they keep pushing and pushing. And some of this is fueled by, just by jealousy. The fact that they don't have a Silicon Valley. The fact that they don't have this big tech company like Facebook or Google or Apple. But they're going after the tech industry. Just recently, you've had some stories in the news about how much more strict it might be with respect to using copyrighted content. If they had their way, some of them, they'd do away with fair use laws and just enabling us to do what we do so often on this program, quoting excerpts, playing excerpts. Well, we've got to make sure that we've got to have all these checks in place to make sure that copyrighted content is protected. It always sounds good. Well, of course, you want to protect someone's intellectual property. But the more and more strict it becomes, well, the more difficult it is to produce good content. Just as a small example, when we send our live link, as many of you know, to our station in Edmond, Oklahoma. It's a wonderful technology. We've got the live recording here at Edstone at our office. And then 10 minutes before, we'll send the link. We'll play Holst's Jupiter, just a classical piece. And it's a version that we own the copyrights to. So we're allowed to play it. It's no problem. We do it to check that the stream is working and so on. Happens every day. And as some of you know, when we had that power outage a week and a half ago, 2 weeks ago, we instead of doing the stream as per normal, we did it on YouTube, and we went through the same process. We played Jupiter to start the show minutes before the actual show happened, just so that when people are getting online or when they're getting into the YouTube stream, they can see that, yeah, we're getting some audio. Well, that video was immediately flagged by YouTube for copyright violation. They didn't take it down, thankfully. But sometimes they'll do that. You hear cases of this pretty routinely now. And what happens when they say, look, there may be a copyright violation here, is that we then have to respond to dispute the claim. And then we have to submit evidence that we have the rights to the song in question. And then, supposing they did take it down, then they put it back up. But you can just imagine how long and drawn out this process could be, how cumbersome it would be for a small outfit that doesn't have a very big budget, or that's not working with 20 or 30 technicians. It's basically a guilty until proven innocent model. If we suspect that there's copyright infringement, then you're guilty. We've got to pull it down. We've got to take it down until you can prove you're innocent. That's the way that it goes. Now, look, in a lot of ways, the internet is not trafficked enough. And you have all kinds of evil, vile garbage that's available, widely available, all across the world. And then in cases where you actually have the truth, there's tight restrictions. It's just the way that it's been in man's society. Everything that we touch, it seems, we think, oh, well, there's this issue, we'll create another law, and that'll fix the problem. And maybe it fixes it to some degree, but then it introduces other problems. It shows how much we need. It shows how much we need the government of God. It shows how much we need God's law. It shows how much we need God's family administering that law of God. There's these massive tech companies, I think it's here in my notes somewhere, where they just basically, I don't know if it was Google or Facebook, where they pay more in EU fines every year than they do in taxes in the United States. Google paid 5 billion euro just last year because of EU fines. They have it in for Google. And Google's not alone. Wikipedia, all these massive tech companies. This one article here from Electronic Frontier Foundation. It says, despite ringing denunciations from small EU tech businesses, giant EU entertainment companies, artist groups, technical experts, and human rights experts, the largest body of concerned citizens in EU history, the EU has concluded its trilogies on the new copyright directive, striking a deal that amazingly is worse than any in the directive's sordid history. I don't know if I got that one word right, but there's a lot of resistance. That's the gist of it here. There's a lot of resistance, and yet the EU just continues on in its obstinance, slapping down fines, drawing up new legislation, implementing new, more restrictive laws. Now, this latest, this making it tougher for people to use copyrighted material, this is something that hopefully won't pass the EU Parliament. But anything can happen. Anything can happen. Mr. McDonald, in that trumpet brief, he says here, many consider it an attempt not only to curb the power of America's big technology companies, but to literally take over the internet. He says further on, all this is not to say Google, Facebook, and America's big technology companies in general are above reproach. To be sure, there are genuine concerns and questions about the behavior of these companies and their inordinate push, or rather power and reach. That said, do we really want a handful of anti-American European bureaucrats trying to solve these problems? And then you add to that, how's America going to push back? Because they will. Donald Trump has proven himself to be someone who will fight back with tariffs of his own. You can see how that this would escalate in a hurry We've had so much to say about trade war and how it's prophesied in the Mart of Nations chapter over in Isaiah. Trade war and how that the United States and Great Britain, they're going to be left out of this international trade alliance. And you see it going in that direction with this America-EU split. You see it going in that direction with the negotiations over Brexit. So clear, some of these prophecies are coming right into a sharp, sharp focus. Well, we'll have to get into more of this next week. We'll be having some, quite a variety of programs and presenters on next week's programming list. So you want to make sure that you tune in as per usual, wherever you happen to listen in from, whether it's to the live stream or to the podcast. Another week of exciting broadcasting coming up for you next week. As for this week, we thank you for joining us on the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. Thank you for joining us today and all through this week, and we'll see you next week.